Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The whole world, and America above all, knows that made in China means bargain basement deals. $5 t-shirts, $500 computers. American manufacturers have long sounded alarms over Chinese competitors emerging at their expense. Well, today those U.S. manufacturers won a small victory that could have large ultimate consequences for the U.S. economy. China announced today that it will no longer peg its currency, the yuan, to the dollar. Until now, China's pegged currency has made its goods artificially cheap in the United States. Now China will let the yuan float, but within a narrow band. What's at stake? Well, perhaps a lot. From the U.S. trade deficit and debt to prices at Walmart and the interest rate you pay, maybe even what your house is worth. Tonight on Point, China's currency unbound and what that may mean for the U.S. economy and for you. Joining me now to talk about today's announcement from China is Greg Ip, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, good to have you with us.
Good evening, Tom.
So here we go. A baby step, Senator Charles Schumer of New York called it. He's been clamoring for this. So a modest step, but how big a deal? What are the implications?
Tom, I think it has very important symbolic implications, but for the present, only minor practical implications. Let me explain. It's symbolically important because China, as you know, has been basically moving away from a socialist economy for the last 10 to 20 years, gradually freeing up its economy, allowing entrepreneurs and private companies to take over more and more of the production of goods and services. The fact that they had this fixed exchange rate and that they maintained tight controls of money coming in and out of the country was one of the most important remaining vestiges of their controlled economy. And the fact that they're moving away from that is potentially very important in terms of China making the full transition to a market-based economy like ours here. But in practical terms, I think the importance that right now is quite small. First of all, for now, it's just a 2% move in the yuan. Mm-hmm. And I don't know any economist who thinks that will have any noticeable impact on our economy at all. I mean, this is a country where wage rates are probably less than 10% on average of those in the United States. So a 2% increase in the Chinese cost is simply not going to have much of a competitive impact.
And Washington had been calling for a 10 or 15% revaluation.
Yes. Now, the Bush administration had not put a specific number on how big a revaluation they wanted, but clearly there are plausible estimates out there that it ought to be anywhere from 10, 15 to 30% higher. Now, in time, that could happen, and indeed, that is exactly what the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve do expect, that over time, the Chinese will permit this 2% increase to become 5, 10%, something larger. And that would begin to have a small impact. But there will be an even bigger impact when you consider that other countries in Asia, like Japan, like Taiwan, like Korea, have been holding their exchange rates down against the dollar as well because they didn't want to lose competitive positioning against the Chinese. They will now feel more comfortable letting their currencies rise, and that will multiply the impact.
Reading here, a senior economist with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences in Beijing saying today, the most important thing is the change, not how much it changed. The implication, as you suggest, Greg, that in the future it could go further. It could float more freely with what that suggests. Remind us of the network of pieces of the U.S. economy that are tied to the value of the Chinese currency, all of its potential impacts.
Definitely, Tom. I mean, this is definitely a situation where you must be careful what you ask for because you just might get it. Because the Chinese currency policy has impacted more than just our trade deficit with them. It's also had a big impact on interest rates. And let me explain for a second. When the Chinese run a very large trade surplus with us, it was over $150 billion in the last 12 months, they have to do something with the dollars that they accumulate. And by and large, they put them into Treasury bonds and other U.S. securities. When they buy those bonds, they're basically holding down the interest rates on those bonds. And that has a benefit throughout the economy. It's been holding down mortgage rates, and that has been one of the reasons that the housing market has been so strong. Now, if the Chinese need to, if they need to buy fewer dollars going forward because they've changed their currency policy, that could result in fewer purchases of bonds and perhaps higher interest rates. And in fact, when the markets learned this news today, that's exactly what they did in response. They raised long-term interest rates.
And what about consumer prices in the U.S., Greg? I mean, we know very well our shelves are full of Chinese goods.
Sure,
how
yeah.
big a float, how big a change in the value of the Chinese currency would it take for American consumers to begin to feel it when they buy their blue jeans or running shoes or you name it?
Well, again, I don't think they're going to notice anything with this very minor move. When you buy a pair of shoes or a piece of furniture that's made in China, in fact, the portion of the price that is the Chinese manufacturing cost is not that large. A lot of it is the retail markup and the transportation cost of getting it here. But again, if the Chinese allow this to go further than the original 2%, it will begin to show up. Now, I wouldn't expect that a lot of manufacturers who've been like setting up factories in China to suddenly close them down and move them back to the United States. More likely, you will see them perhaps move the factories to other countries that now seem more cost-effective, for example, Vietnam or the Philippines or even India.
Always another country where things are a little cheaper, but a significant, as you say, shift in China, if only symbolic for now, with potential deeper ramifications down the road. Greg, thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, it's always a pleasure.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about China's decision to scrap its decade-long policy of pegging its currency, the yuan, to the U.S. dollar. You can join the conversation. Have you been following the link between your cheap consumer goods and China's currency? And now that China has budged a little, does the future look brighter to you or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Jeffrey Frankel, professor of capital formation and growth at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He directs the program in international finance and macroeconomics at the National Bureau of Economics Research and is a former member of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. Jeffrey Frankel, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
Also with us from Washington is Morris Goldstein, a senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics, a Washington think tank. He is former deputy director of the International Monetary Fund's Research Department and is author of Controlling Currency Mismatches in Emerging Markets. Morris Goldstein, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Jeffrey Frankel, to you first. Greg Ipp was saying, be careful what you wish for there. It's a very small move by the Chinese today, but can you describe how this is a sword that could cut two ways for the United States?
Well, it is. I mean, let me say I agree with everything Greg Ipp said, but before your viewers think this is going to be a dull show, I think we'll get some real disagreement later on. It is very much a two-edged sword. Let's review quickly the big picture. U.S. trade deficits running at record levels. For the last 2 years, American politicians of both parties have been pressuring China to abandon its peg to the dollar with the idea that then their currency would appreciate. And I'm going to call their currency the renminbi. It's got two names.
Fine.
But when you say yuan, some people think you're saying yen, which is a Japanese currency. So I'm going to say renminbi. Sounds more Chinese.
Either way.
People's currency. So the goal, of course, is to make things easier for U.S. exporters so they'll be more competitive, and also for U.S. firms that compete with imports for example, those T-shirt makers or computer manufacturers. And China's finally done it. China has finally abandoned its peg. My guess is, in the long run, the currency is going to move quite a ways. And if it was only China alone, it wouldn't make that much difference to U.S. exporters. We just go back to buying the same goods from other Asian countries the way we used to. But judging from today's moves, where Malaysia moved at the same time and the yen, Japanese yen appreciated, I think this actually probably does signal a major break in a major new long-run trend.
And does that mean that American manufacturers are suddenly, I don't know, next year or in 5 years if the trend continues, going to be more competitive, selling American goods to China or more American goods to Americans because these Asian goods won't be as competitive?
I think that will happen eventually, even though it'll take some time. But the two-edged sword is exactly right. Be careful what you wish for. It's exactly right because the implication would be higher U.S. interest rates, higher prices at Walmart, higher prices for T-shirts and personal computers. It would create trouble for a lot of Americans with mortgages, I think, because if you reduce the U.S. trade deficit, you're also reducing capital inflows, and you're telling those Chinese, stop buying our Treasury securities, and that means the prices of Treasury securities go down, interest rates go up, mortgage holders get hit.
Go up right along with them. Morris Goldstein, a tiny step today. How far would the yuan or the renminbi have to move before it began to impact prices in American retail outlets or interest rates in the United States in a perceptible way?
Well, the move that we saw yesterday is just minimal. I mean, this really is spitting in the ocean. It's 2%. That's not going to have any impact on China's balance of payments. It's going to have practically no impact on the U.S. balance of payments. It's not going to have much impact on the strong protectionist pressures in the U.S. Congress. It's not going to silence those who say China is manipulating its currency. So I would say today's announcement is a disappointment. I think we needed about a 20% revaluation in the Chinese RMB, and we got very, very little, and there's really no assurance that it's going to be bigger over the next year.
So you are looking at this as what, a kind of a wink and nod to take political pressure off China without substantially changing the relationship between the currencies?
Well, I think they could have taken much bolder action. They decided to do very little. I think that's a mistake, both from China's point of view and from the U.S. point of view. Given that the disequilibrium is so big and we need such a large change, I think what the small change is going to mean is people are going to expect further changes down the road. They're going to expect further revaluations. That means that there are profits to be made by being long in the RMB. And what's going to happen is you're going to get more capital inflows into China, which is going to make their situation more more difficult. And when you do get a change, it's going to be a very large change, and it may happen in a chaotic way, which could have much worse effects for U.S. interest rates and for the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm. Martin Goldstein, Jeffrey Frankel, we've got to take a short break. I want to come back and look at exactly that. Of course, Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham in the Senate have been calling for 27.5% tariffs on Chinese goods. They backed down a little bit today, but said this isn't enough. We'll have to see more. We're talking tonight about China's currency unpegged from the U.S. dollar. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China's currency, unbound, the Chinese yuan or renminbi, unpegged from the U.S. dollar, and what that will mean, may foreshadow, for the U.S. economy and for you. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you followed the link between your cheap consumer goods and China's currency? Are you aware that your low mortgage rate and your cheap car loan have been underwritten by Beijing? And is this the beginning of a boon for American manufacturers, a step in the right direction? Will a stronger Chinese currency make American industry more competitive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Washington by Morris Goldstein, Senior Fellow at the Institute for International Economics. With me in the studio tonight, Jeffrey Frankel, Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Right now, joining us from Buffalo, New York, is Bob Buchanan. He's in the retail industry group at the brokerage A.G. Edwards, an analyst there on all things retail. Bob, thanks for being with us tonight.
No problem. I'm actually in New York City. I didn't make it to Buffalo, so.
Oh, we're sorry.
Slight correction. Yeah.
Okay. We've got you placed in New York. How do you read this change out of China in the pegging to the U.S. dollar? How do you read it immediately, the impact of this very small change, and how do you read the importance of it unhooking from the dollar longer term in terms of consumer prices in this country?
Well, I think immediately there'll be very little impact, but down the road I think there will be an impact. A lot of the U.S. retailers currently buy in U.S. dollars out of China, so immediately they're acting like there's not going to be any problem. But it would seem to me that to the extent that the yuan does have a higher value, labor costs in China are going to be valued at a higher level, and over time I would look for some increase in prices, costs and prices. And I think if you look at retailers over the last several years, their profits have been greatly benefited from the artificially low prices out of China.
So if we're shoppers at Walmart or anywhere else where we've got a lot of Chinese imports, Are you looking at kind of inexorable higher prices there? Does this mean cutting into the American standard of living? Does this mean inflation in the U.S. or simply lower profits ultimately for U.S. retailers?
I think we could get a little inflation. We could get some lower profits, and I think we get a combination. If you look at Walmart shoes, for example, close to 100% of the footwear they sell is made in China. And I just think the plain fact, if you take a step back, is that prices out of China have been artificially low because of the yuan-dollar peg rate. And I think with reality setting in, with market forces setting in over time, with the yuan appreciating, rightly so, versus the dollar, I think there certainly will be some upward valuation. There's got a lot of cross currents. A lot of companies like Walmart will source out of other countries that are even lower cost than China, moving into Indonesia and India, Sri Lanka, other places like that. But I think we will get a whiff of inflation, again, over time, not immediately.
So are American retailers going to look back at the late 90s, the early part of this century, as a kind of golden time for profits when China was essentially subsidizing them, underwriting their profits?
I think to some extent that's true. I mean, to some extent, retailers benefit from a whiff of inflation, which you might get also to help them to leverage some of their fixed costs on a labor front, for example, in their stores here in the United States. But yeah, I think that there has been a bit of a bailout, if you will, on the gross margin side. And I put out a cautionary comment today to my institutional clients around the world. And I just think that there is going to be pressure on retailers' earnings moving forward because the easy game in China is over.
And what about American consumers? Just for another minute here, Bob, they've had those same years of being able to go out and buy clothing, for example, for sometimes what seemed like almost nothing. Should they imagine that era passing?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think certainly from China, prices will go up over time. But again, I think there's a lot of other production out there. The plain fact is, though, in a number of those other countries, they don't have the technological base that they do in China. So I think what we'll see in China over time is a situation not unlike Hong Kong, where some of the highest quality production, some of the more sophisticated techniques for cutting and sewing garments will take place in China as opposed to other nations. And some of the countries like Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and India will do some of the lower quality production.
Bob Buchanan at A.G. Edwards, Retail Industry Group Leader there. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Bob Buchanan in New York. All right, Jeffrey Frankel, Morris Goldstein, let's go deeper into these woods, because clearly, whatever the scale of the announcement in the last day, we're talking big stuff long term here. Jeffrey, Morris says they made a big mistake by not having a much bigger move in the yuan, in the renminbi, this week, that it should be maybe 20%. That sounds gigantic. Could China have done that?
I think 20% in one day would have been very disruptive. I mean, Morris and I basically agree on the on where we're going to get to in the long run, but I would disagree with him completely on the details of this. I think tactically it was absolutely brilliant on the part of the Chinese. I think the timing was brilliant. I think the new mechanism, which is pretty complicated, is not a simple fix, and it's not floating. It's interesting hybrid.
It's 2% today, but there's a band, kind of an 8% maximum that it could move.
The band is very narrow, so on any given day it can move plus or minus 0.3%. So that's even less than 2%. That's nothing. But in theory, it could do that every day. And if the inflows were strong enough, which Morris thinks they will be, evidently, that adds up to more than 6% a month, and that could be could make a real difference before long. So we'll have to wait and see before as to what will really happen.
Morris Goldstein, China's president Hu Jintao visiting the U.S. in September, so they may in part be trying to kind of smooth the way for that visit. But before the break, you were saying they've made a big mistake by not doing more, and it's going to come back and bite China. Let's look at their side of this equation first. How do you see that scenario unfolding?
Well, I think President Hu is going to find it a little easier now that they've done something. But, you know, what they've done is so small. The change in the exchange rate is tiny. The change in the band which the exchange rate can move is very small. While it's true it could move 0.3% every day, and if you add that up over 30 days, you get a number, there's no assurance it will do that. And even if it did do that, it really doesn't help China to spread out an exchange rate change like this over a month or two. If we're talking about several years, that's a different story. But I don't think China gets any great advantage by trying to spread this out over a few months.
But you've said there's a comeuppance waiting for China because of this kind of slowness or how small the steps is. What is that? How would that play out?
Well, if people agree that what is needed is a large exchange rate change, let's say 15 or 20, and they see only two, well, they say, well, there's much more to come before this market clears, and we're going to see more next month. We're going to see more the month after that. We're going to see more 6 months down the road, and gee, we can profit from that. So if they think the value of the RMB is going to go up, everybody in China who can lay their hands on a loan in RMB is going to try and do that because it's going to be worth more, and you can repay in cheaper dollars, so you get more capital inflow, and that's a problem because a lot of that winds up leaking into excess bank loans and into too rapid expansion of the monetary aggregates. That's what happened in 2003 in the first quarter of 2004.
Overheated.
That was in China, and that was very expensive. And the only way they were able to stop it is by putting these very strong administrative controls on bank lending and investment projects and land use, really moving away from the way a market economy works. And they have to worry that people in the United States, in the Congress in particular, are going to get impatient. China has a huge imbalance. It's not getting smaller. It's getting larger. And we have bills in the Congress by Senator Schumer and Graham, among others, saying that if China doesn't do anything significant, substantial, well, then they're going to slap a large tariff on China's exports to the United States.
27.5%. Chuck Schumer saying today, this is a good first step, albeit a baby step. It's smaller than we had hoped. But to paraphrase the Chinese philosophers, says the U.S. Senator, a trip of 1,000 miles can well begin with the first baby step. Jeffrey Frankel, help us look at the American side of this equation. I mean, on the one hand, U.S. manufacturers have complained they're getting creamed because they can't compete with this artificially suppressed currency. On the other, China's underwriting a lot of that very debt it's helping to create, and we're told the U.S. depends on that, and already today we've seen some reaction in the bond market. What are the contingencies on the American side of the equation?
Well, I mean, the big problem is that our problems come from a low national saving rate. And given that we have low national saving, we have very meager private saving, and what there is going to finance a little bit of huge budget deficit. That's our real problem. And blaming it on China doesn't really help because it's going to show up either in the interest rate or the exchange rate one way or another. And nothing, China could do whatever we wanted them to do, and that wouldn't solve that problem. But let me also say a few things that I think, I agree with much of what Morris said, a few things that I think he's missing on the Chinese side. One is, yes, this will probably produce renewed capital inflows into China, expecting even more appreciation. I think the Chinese can handle it. I mean, they've still got capital controls they can put on inflows. They can fiddle with the weights in their basket, but not getting the technicalities too much. They can intervene heavily. They're actually ready. They can sterilize, meaning they can prevent the money supply from growing too rapidly and keep inflation down. They can do all that. The other thing that I think he's missing is the Chinese politics. If China were to give in and do a 15% revaluation of the currency just before coming and seeing President Bush, the Chinese government would lose legitimacy in the eyes of its own people. It would be obviously admitting that it was bowing to foreign pressure, and that they just weren't going to do, and I don't blame them. So it was one of the ways in which this was very clever was the timing. Nobody was expecting it now. The markets weren't expecting it now. It wasn't just before the visit. It was well before the visit.
Let's bring our callers into this conversation. Aiden is calling from Ripon, Wisconsin. Hi, Aiden. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I had two kind of basic questions. The first one was just whether you could give maybe like a brief summary about global or the way these floating currencies function in whatever system they grew out of in the global economy. And second of all, I'll just hang up after I ask this.
Sure.
And you can answer. Was whether this at all signaled like a shift in focus from China, you know, on export focus to a more domestic market and looking inward rather than outward.
Great. We'll pick those up, Aiden, and thanks for your call. Jeffrey, let me put that to you, the kind of ABCs of currencies interacting and floating here.
Right. Well, up until 1971 or 73, virtually all the currencies in the world were pegged. That was a system that was agreed at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944, and it held up until about 30 years ago.
That is, they had a fixed value in relation to one another.
Right, in relation to the dollar, and mm-hmm. the dollar was on gold, and everybody was pegged to everything was mm-hmm. pegged to everything else, just about. And that proved not to be sustainable. What kept it going was central banks agreeing to buy however many dollars or sell however many other currencies was necessary to keep the exchange rate fixed.
But it didn't work because fundamentally currencies should reflect the strength of the economy behind them?
Yes, and also because we've had more and more capital mobility. So China now is sort of where the rest of the world was 30 years ago, which mm-hmm. is that it has controls on international capital movements. When speculators see a slight change in interest rates or they think maybe a currency is going to go up, they can't move all the money in. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think why they moved now, because there are limitations on how much on the ability of speculators
to. But let's keep it at the primer level here. Compare, let's say, how the dollar moves in the currency markets to how the renminbi or yuan does.
Yeah. So the trend has been a broad trend. We've got 180 currencies in the world, roughly speaking, and the broad trend has been increased flexibility, that they used to be pretty fixed, and they've been getting more and more flexible. Some of them float freely. The U.S. dollar floats freely. A relatively new phenomenon is some currencies of developing countries float freely. Mexican peso, Brazilian real float pretty freely. At the other end of the spectrum, you have Hong Kong, which is rigidly pegged.
To the dollar.
Right, rigidly pegged to the dollar. And then you have a lot of other currencies in between. And one of the reasons why this is interesting, what China has done today, is what it has opted for is very clearly something in between. Neither pegged and fixed, nor free-floating like Brazil, Mexico, or the United States. And it's an interesting hybrid that they've come up
with. And is pegging a currency always seen as cheating? I mean, China's pegging has been seen as kind of exploiting somehow the American market by keeping its goods artificially inexpensive.
Well, I don't see it that way at all. And here's where you should give Morris a chance to say why he thinks it is. But my view is a country should be allowed under the international rules and are allowed under the international rules to choose whatever regime it wanted. And then they were pegged to the dollar. And I don't see how you can accuse them of unfair manipulation as if there was some violation of some trade treaty because of that.
Morris Goldstein, it sounds like you would take the opposite view there.
Well, I think China has not been playing by the rules on currency. The IMF rules allow countries to intervene in exchange markets, but they qualify that. They say that if you intervene, you shouldn't do so in a large-scale way, you shouldn't do it in a prolonged fashion, and you shouldn't do it in just one-way direction. And that's precisely what China has been doing over the past 2.5 to 3 years, and by doing so, they've been keeping the value of the RMB artificially low, and they've been preventing effective adjustment in China's balance of payments. So you can do some intervening. There's nothing wrong with that, but when you're doing it on the scale that China's been doing, $200 billion increase in reserves last year alone and likely more this year, and it's always on the same side of the market, what that's telling you is you have the wrong exchange rate and you need to change it. The problem in China is they've been very reluctant to do so, and what we saw yesterday was a very, very small change.
And what about our caller Aiden's question about China looking more toward internal markets rather than exporting? I can see you do not see that in this move, but can you see anywhere on the horizon a time when China's economy has grown to such a size that it's less voraciously looking to markets abroad?
Well, I think that will happen, and I think China will be nudged in that direction simply because you can't keep GDP growing year after year just on larger and larger net export surpluses. Net exports have grown very rapidly this year and are providing much of China's high growth. They need to rely more on the domestic sources of growth. And one of the problems they have there is they have a very inefficient financial system. So they need to improve that financial system so they can get more growth out of the domestic part of the economy, and so that they don't engage in beggar-thy-neighbor exchange rate policies.
Let's get a quick call before the break. David's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is this. Is this move by the Chinese government a bit of a tit-for-tat regarding the thwarted takeover of Unocal?
The big American oil company.
Yes, yes. I'm just wondering if there's any connection that they're playing some sort of chess game here.
Let us look at it, David. Jeffrey Frankel, what do you say?
I mean, my view is that we really have mixed up priorities. We have 10 issues, 20 issues we want to pursue with China, and the exchange rate, even though I think that the renminbi does need to move upward, the idea that this should be at the top of our list is nuts. The idea that Unocal should be high on our list is nuts. We need their help to deal with North Korea. That should be on the top of the list. That's important.
But there's an American economy, and people are very concerned about it. And they see China, you know, having these great surpluses, the United States having lots of red ink. Yes, Korea's got nukes, but they're not flying. But the economy never stops working.
Well, if the nukes start flying, that's going to seem a lot more important. And the real point is our trade deficit originates in Washington with our high budget deficit.
We'll come back and look at that. Jeffrey Frankel, Morris Goldstein, thanks for being with us tonight. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking about China's currency unpegged today from the U.S. dollar. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Did China just blink a little? Or is this in Beijing's own interest? Did the U.S. win? Or is it planting new problems for itself? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China's currency unbound, the Chinese yuan, the renminbi, unpegged from the U.S. dollar, and what that may foreshadow for the U.S. economy and for you. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is this the start of a climb in U.S. interest rates? Is it the pin that pricks the U.S. housing bubble? And will made in China still be the Walmart bottom line if this trend line continues? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Washington by Morris Goldstein, a senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics, a think tank there in Washington. In the studio with me tonight, Jeffrey Frankel, professor of capital formation and growth at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And right now, also joining us from Washington, Clyde Prestowitz, a top U.S. trade negotiator with Japan in the Reagan administration. He's now president of the Economic Strategy Institute in Washington. His new book, and we talked about it with him recently, is 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. Clyde Prestowitz, thanks for joining us tonight.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So we just heard from Jeffrey Frankel saying, you know, it's all well and good to talk about China's currency and where it's pegged and how it's pegged, but the real problems in this relationship economically between the U.S. and China are in Washington, not in Beijing. What do you say to that, Clyde?
I think both statements are true. We have a kind of a distorted global economic structure in which the United States consumes and doesn't save. We save too little, consume too much, and a number of Asian countries, among them China, save too much and consume too little.
So is this step in the last 24 hours a step on the road to fixing that or not?
A very small step. It's not going to have, I mean, in the immediate term, it's going to have very little effect on changing these imbalances because essentially the savings and consumption behavior is not changing.
And do you think the Chinese are making a nod to a future in which they're going to let their currency float much further, or do you see this as kind of gilding the lily in advance of President Hu Jintao's visit to Washington, let's say?
I think it's a very shrewd move by the Chinese from several points of view. It relieves the pressure from Washington. It gives them more flexibility in dealing with their own internal financial problems. It gives them a way to adjust in the future, but under control, so that they can continue with their industrial policies and export-led strategies. And they've kind of thrown Washington a meager bone. Washington will praise them. Who will be able to come to Washington in September? We'll have a red carpet rolled out at the White House. I think, for the Chinese, I think it's a win all the way around.
And what about Morris Goldstein was saying earlier, they could have, should have let the renminbi move a lot further, maybe 10-20%.
Yeah, I was surprised. I agree with Morris. I was surprised by the meagerness of the move. I thought it might be between 5-10%, so 2% seemed really small to me.
But is there a point, Clyde, at which you worry that it would spark inflation in the United States, at which you worry that the Chinese wouldn't be there to underwrite all that U.S. red ink?
Well, not being there to underwrite the red ink, has to be a concern, but you have to remember that underwriting the red ink is good for the Chinese, too, because it keeps their export machine going. So I don't have too much immediate fear of that. And as far as inflation is concerned, they could have moved, taken a much bigger move without having much impact on inflation in the U.S.
Let me take a call here. Jay is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for the call.
Yeah.
I have a question concerning overseas manufacturing. I'm actually going to be losing my job because my company is sending work to factories in China, Thailand, and Mexico.
Ouch.
And I was wondering if, because of the change in the Chinese currency, would more jobs go overseas, or would things actually start to get pulled back to the United States?
Let us pick it up. Clyde, let me put that first to you.
In theory, the strengthening of the Chinese currency should help you save your job, but the move is so small, and on top of that, the difference in cost of production between China and the U.S. is so large that as a practical matter, I don't think it's going to be any help.
Morris Goldstein, do you see relief for Jay or others like him anywhere on the horizon on the job loss overseas front?
I don't, frankly. Most of the competition that China faces is not with the United States, but with other low-cost producers. So even if we saw China by itself make a larger change, what we'd see is a lot more substitution toward other low-cost emerging economy producers, not so much toward U.S. producers. So in order to help U.S. producers, what we need is a broad-based decline in the dollar relative to many currencies. That's the only way really to improve U.S. competitiveness.
And what might precipitate that?
Pardon?
What might precipitate that broad-based decline in the dollar's value?
Well, we need the Chinese move to be bigger, and we need all of Asia to follow along, because China's weight is only 10% in the dollar, but Asia, including Japan, is 40%. So that's what we're really looking for. We want others to follow the Chinese currency up.
Jeffrey Frankel, I heard you, I think, reading the tea leaves earlier and saying that there's some indications that might happen. But A, do you think it will? And B, if it does that get us to keeping jobs in the United States, or does it all still come back to Washington, U.S. spending and saving?
Well, very interesting set of questions. Malaysia, the Malaysian ringgit also revalued today. This was obviously mm-hmm. coordinated carefully ahead of time, Malaysia being the only other country in Asia that was actually, like China, pegged to the dollar. The yen, I think, moved up on markets today pretty sharply, and I wouldn't be surprised if, when the markets open in Asia, that the Korean won and the new Taiwan dollar go up too. So far, it seems like the others are probably moving the same direction. If they didn't, if it were just China alone, then even a big one wouldn't do much. It would just relocate, as was just said. The goods that we used to buy from Korea and are now buying from China, we'd go back to buying from Korea again. As far as Jay and Newton
wanting his job back.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's nothing. It's got my he's got my sympathy. But let's ask why globalization worked so well in the 1990s. Because after all, in the 1990s, we had very rapidly growing imports. We did have firms relocating overseas. It was an issue. And yet globalization, free trade had a lot of support. And the reason was that U.S. exports were growing very rapidly as well. And so the number of jobs being created was, through exports and various other ways as well, was substantially greater than the number of jobs being lost.
What's happened to that?
It's turned around completely.
Why?
I'm not sure exactly why, but, we heard during the last presidential campaign this statistic that President Bush was the first president since Herbert Hoover to complete his term with fewer jobs than he began. Another statistic, which was true true, but one didn't hear as often, equally true, was that I believe First President were to complete his term with exports lower than when he started it. So in addition to the trade deficit, the difference between exports and imports, I think we want to look at the total. And I like to see a world where all countries are growing, all countries are importing, all countries are exporting, all countries are gaining jobs.
Clyde Prestowitz, where do you put the root of that declining U.S. export number? Does Beijing have responsibility for that, or does the responsibility elsewhere? Why did it turn down? How do we turn it around?
Well, I think one factor is that the crash of the NASDAQ bubble in 2000 led many U.S. manufacturers to move offshore. And so production that in the 90s was in the U.S., some of it being exported, suddenly moved to China and elsewhere in Asia. And you had a dramatic shift in the trade balance between 2000 and today.
Clyde, is there an inevitability, a comeuppance, I don't know, for the United States in here somewhere? Does there come a point at which China won't underwrite that sea of red ink anymore? The consumer prices don't stay perpetually low? Somehow,
well, I think a point was made earlier, it's not just China. Remember that Japan is a major player in this. Other Asian countries are also significant players. They're all underwriting our debt, and they're all managing their currencies. Now, there are things that in the long term will make this unsustainable. If for no other reason, the U.S. is now soaking up about 80% of available world savings. So when you get to 100%, the game has to stop. Asian populations are aging. Japan is already shrinking in population. Their savings pool is likely to shrink over time, making it more difficult for them to fund our debt. There's always a chance of some kind of a financial crisis, a hedge fund like long-term capital management in 1998, or other unexpected happenings that could cause some kind of a crisis that would send this whole house of cards collapsing. Nobody knows exactly when or how, but, you know, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker has predicted a 75% chance of a major financial crisis in the next 5 years. So this is a very uncertain, fragile situation.
And in the meantime, and Clyde, we've just got half a minute here, Senators Schumer and Graham have been bandying about their tariff legislation that would put a 27.5% tariff increase or tariff on all Chinese goods. They didn't get the size of a movement in the currency that they wanted today. Do you think that's dead, or is that still around? Might that still be threatened?
It's not dead, but it'll probably sleep for a while in the wake of today's announcement by Beijing.
Well, there it is. A little move with all kinds of implications around it, and three great minds helping us think about it tonight. Clyde Prestowitz in Washington, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
Clyde Prestowitz, his new book is 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. And Morse Goldstein, also in Washington, senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics, author of Controlling Currency Mismatches in Emerging Markets. Thanks for joining us tonight, Mr. Goldstein.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And Jeffrey Frankel, with me in the studio this evening, professor of capital formation and growth at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, former member of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being here this evening.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the story of your household trash. This is On Point. Americans generate 1.3 tons of garbage per capita per year. All those candy wrappers, old newspapers, and diapers end up on the curb on trash day, and then, miraculously, they're all carried away, never to be seen again. Science writer Elizabeth Reut always wondered what happened to her trash after she left it at the curb. She decided to follow her disposables, her recyclables, even her sewage, to see just where it ended up. She traveled to some of the dirtiest places on Earth and wrote about her journeys in her new book, Garbage Land. In this radio diary, Elizabeth Reut explains why she followed the garbage.
Like many people, I've often wondered what happens to garbage after I put it on my curb, where it goes and what happens to it exactly. But then I met an agronomist who started talking to me about ecological footprints and the amount of material and energy and land it takes to make the goods that we use and refuse every day. And I started thinking that ecological footprints had a back end. There was a garbage footprint also. And I knew that since New York's local landfill on Staten Island called Freshkills had closed, that New York's garbage footprint must be larger than it had ever been, and that our waste was going far and wide. And I got this idea that my garbage consisted of four different streams, and I conceived of this book as a travel book, and that I would have these four different adventures following the different streams from my kitchen, and then where I pulled them apart and put them on the curb and followed them to their final resting place. One of the waste streams that I followed was recyclables, and in New York that's glass, metal, plastic, and paper. And I learned that paper is being made back into new paper, which is a great thing. Recycled metal is the first feedstock of steel mills, so all of that steel that you put on the curb eventually makes its way back into a new steel product. Plastic, much of it ends up in China because China is paying more for this material than domestic recyclers. And some of the plastic, especially if it's collected through a bottle bill program, is being used in this country and made into carpeting and fleece jackets and sleeping bags. Glass is a little bit more problematic. In New York, glass is pulverized and sent out to a landfill and used as alternative daily cover. And that means it's like used as a blanket to cover the garbage at the end of the day. And federal law requires that landfills cover up the waste at the end of the day to keep down rats and birds and keep odors and dust down. In many communities that recycle glass, the glass is remade into new containers. On the West Coast, especially, green glass ends up in Gallo wine bottles. It's also used by the aerospace industry, and it's used in fiberglass. So there are markets for glass in some places. The problem is that glass is heavy, so it's expensive to transport. So if there isn't someone who wants the glass nearby, it often ends up pulverized and used as cover in landfills. At a recycling roundtable in New York, I met a gentleman who works for the Department of Environment in San Francisco, and he told me that his city was working toward a zero-waste goal in the year 2020, and that the city was aiming for a 75% diversion by 2015. And he invited me out to his city to see how San Francisco was intensively recycling and composting organic waste. And hanging around with this guy was a lot of fun, because he and another man who worked for the program were zero-waste poster children, and they were each sort of competing with each other to see who could leave a smaller human stain. And I went out to lunch with them, and they didn't use their napkins, and they wiped their plate clean, and they told me that they were diverting 95% of the waste from their kitchen trash cans. And at this one man's office, he had a ball of staples that he couldn't bear to throw out because it was valuable ferrous scrap. And I asked him what was in the 5% of his trash at home, and he said it was durable goods, most recently a pair of shoes that he couldn't send back to Nike, which does take some shoes back and turns them into matting in gyms, and twist ties. And I was wondering why he couldn't recycle a twist tie, because as I was doing in my house, it's just paper and metal, and those are two, they're strong markets for paper and metal. But that's the level of obsessiveness I got to. As we see these amounts of waste going up, the waste that we're putting in the ground or burning, we have to also think about the waste that goes into making these products. And that's what I think is the really big problem, because we continue to take virgin materials from the earth, cutting down trees, pulling out oil and gas, mining metals and minerals to make these goods. And it's a one-way flow of materials from the earth through manufacturers to consumers and then into the ground. And it's unsustainable. The waste that we're creating ought to make us think about what's going on upstream and make us think about ways of reusing these things, keeping them cycling through the system.
Elizabeth Wright is author of Garbage Land on the Secret Trail of Trash. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.